thank Katie and Kay listeners once again for tuning in to A Weight Off Your Shoulders. This is Edward Troy, also known as the Liberal Gladiator. And previously, we interviewed Diane Mitz Bush, who is a Democrat running for the Congressional District 3 seat in the Democratic primary that's coming up. And our candidates are, you know, from that party for right now. We're looking to, you know, get other people too from other parties, and we'll be approaching them later on. On the phone, I have Carl Hanlon, who is also in that primary. And one disclosure I want to make is that I am a Democrat, and I am also going to the state assembly and convention on April 14th. With that, Carl, if you can hear me.
Yeah, I'm here, Ed. How are you?
Fantastic, and I want to thank you for being available for the listening audience. And just like with Diane, we're gonna we got a series of questions we're gonna ask, and just tell us what you think, how you feel, and go for it. Okay.
All right. Sounds good. I do want to say one thing before we get started is that you need to be down there on April 13th at 7:15 for the CD3 State Assembly. So make sure you're down there early and don't show up on the 14th.
Well, the only thing is that I was not selected, and my name was not pulled out of the hat in that drawing. Otherwise, I would have been there for that. I did attempt to go there.
Got it.
Yeah, and also we have a mutual friend, Sandy Karp, and great guy, and I'm glad you guys know each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Sandy is fantastic. He's been a partner of mine in the law firm for a long time and one of my favorite people that I get to hang out with.
Awesome. Fantastic. We do physics lectures together. And anyway, so we're going to talk about healthcare today. And just as an overview, I'd like to have just a really broad visionary statement that you might have for healthcare and how you see it, it working for Coloradans as well as for the United States as a whole.
Sure. I think the place we really need to start is that one of the things we really learned is that rolling out large healthcare policy in rural America, it works differently than it does in larger urban areas. And we really learned that with the ACA. It's working in a lot of ways really pretty well in a more dense urban area, say the Front Range, where you have lots of providers and lots of competition. But we definitely struggled to roll it out well in rural America, where you have less health insurance companies, you have less healthcare providers, and frankly, just delivering services are a lot more challenging because of the distances and the remoteness oftentimes of where those things are. So I think the starting point for me is trying to work within the structures we have today. And we have a lot of different things, a lot of different entities providing healthcare and health coverage that some work well, some don't work as well as they could. But we need to recognize that there are systems in place that probably we could make some tweaks to today to get to that real overall goal of universal, accessible, affordable health care for every American, which I think is an absolute right that we have and need as Americans. We should have access to that. And that may, those various ways that gets delivered could be through the VA, where we have a lot of great services being provided to veterans, but we need to work on how we provide those services in rural areas, which is one of the platforms that I'm really talking about in my campaign, to a Medicaid program that perhaps we should be allowing buy-ins to in rural counties that have limited health insurance options to create some competition underneath the ACA, really trying to find some on-the-ground pragmatic solutions to lower costs and increase access today. I know there's a lot of discussion about those broad overarching policies, whether it's a single payer or some other form. We've got things that we need to solve today, and people are really struggling financially with these issues today, and we see how hard it is to implement large-scale policy changes effectively to 350 million people. So my focus in this campaign has really been to focus on what can we do now to help people now, because they need that help immediately, not in several years down the road. We need to take some action today.
I think our listening audience would agree with you, and some of them are probably even aware that the ACA did create an inflection in the curve or the delta change, if you will, in the curve of climbing and escalating prices with inflation. And mm-hmm. but it's still going up, and there are still serious issues. And we're going to attempt to cover those right now. But okay. One thing I want to ask you is, do you see insurance corporate bureaucrats replacing and overseeing medical practice? You see that as a problem with the private intermediaries between healthcare and the actual patient.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we're talking about, do we want to have an intermediary between our healthcare providers, our doctors, our nurses, our other health professionals, mental health professionals, between, you know, should there be a layer between them and a patient? Absolutely not. I mean, I think one of the things that Americans really value is the relationships they have with their providers, their local providers. I know that for me, that the guys that I see, gals that I see in the Valley, I've known for years. And I have relationships with them, so I wouldn't want to see a bureaucracy that separates the two of us, if you will, if that was where you were going with that question.
That is exactly where I'm going, because, you may, and one of the things that I think that people discover is that they have not just a professional, relationship or a client or patient relationship to the, to the doctor or healthcare provider, but there's also chemistry, and that does matter. And so... That definitely something that I really do agree. You know, that does need to be addressed in a very definitive way. I guess one other thing too. We're going to try to get through these things because we're going to hit on some of the things you mentioned, and I'm going to try to get to that. And that would be the rural situation here, because most of the people that are listening, well, unless they're free streaming, they are living in a rural area, and
right.
There's also, we got issues of preventive versus reactive emergency room admissions. And, so we need to take a look at what type of a payment mechanism and how much for universal access would be something that we probably want to cover. And then, of course, we have the usual, what I would call reactive stance, where there's a lot of focus on malpractice, and so there would be this idea of, tort reform. And, maybe the excessive amounts of testing so that the doctor can say, well, look, I did this test and that test and, 29 different tests, and maybe only 3 tests were needed, but these things do cost money. And that's because there is some of that, there are tort issues, and, I don't know how do we get past that? What do we do about that? I mean, I think that if we go to universal or single payer, that probably would take care of that, I'm guessing.
Yeah, one of the things that is a struggle about the concept of single payer is that it's easy to say, it's hard to create and hard to implement. And I think when you think about things like how does it affect the VA, how does it affect 160 to 180 million Americans who get their health insurance through their employer, how does it affect people currently on Medicaid, how does it affect people on Medicare today? The implementation, I think, is one of those things that makes single payer, like I said, it is easy to say, it is difficult to make happen. And also the 600,000 to 800,000 jobs in the health insurance industry that we would need to think about. It's a very that quote from the president who knew that health care was complicated. It's very complicated. So we really need to, we need to think about those things. Jumping to tort reform for a minute, I think that there's a lot tied up in that. It's one of those things that's easy to say, tort reform. And as you know, full disclosure, I'm an attorney. I don't practice malpractice litigation, but I am a practicing attorney. Tort reform, I think we need to be careful about what we do and how much we think it's driving costs versus how much it is, and I don't want to say a red herring, but a little bit of that. There are a lot of other cost drivers out there, things like the poison pill in Medicaid and Medicare, where we can't negotiate for drug prices, that are driving costs and access issues in ways that far outstrip what's going on in terms of a doctor worrying about malpractice or not. They carry significant insurance for that. There's an argument that increases costs. I don't know how much in terms of malpractice is driving the testing versus how much is just trying to provide the best health care they possibly can, and really not having a conversation with patients about what's the value of that test to you and what can it change or what can we learn from that. And that's where that relationship with the doctor, with your doctor, with your health care provider is so important, because I know that when I go in, and I'm a male that's turned 50 last year, turning 51 this year, and I have that conversation with my doctor about, okay, what should I be testing for? What's the value of that? What's the risk if I don't do that? Those are conversations that we really should be having, that it's easy to just say, oh, it's all about tort reform. I think it's as much about developing relationships and being allowed to have those relationships and being informed as a consumer, and having doctors that take the time to talk to you about what it means or it doesn't mean to do that test. And certainly that's one of the things in rural America, it's probably better because we tend to know our providers maybe a little better because they're our friends and neighbors as well.
Right. And so I guess when you're taking a look at that entire thing from a, I guess, an executive position, or you call it a red herring, and I happen to think that's why I call it a reactive stance or position when that's mm-hmm. brought up. But it is brought up, and so in the public domain, and so I feel like that it does need to be addressed, and I think that addressing it as a red herring, to at least to some degree, not saying it does not exist. I do believe it does to some degree, again, but it's very small compared mm-hmm. to some of the other drivers that you did mention.
Right, absolutely.
And and how do you see healthcare, in terms of it still being a privatized situation, and let's say that there's some plan like the ACA that does not expand, Medicare and Medicaid, which are kind of like single payer situations, or the situation with the VA. I guess that's probably single payer too. And what could be, should healthcare costs be taxed, deductible, or things that could be called, preventive in nature. Mm-hmm. In other words, if someone goes, I asked this of Diane, someone goes, to the gym, they work out, they've got their diet under control, they're not eating garbage food, they're not drunks, and they're not, smoking a meth pipe in an alley and drinking with the drunks. And should there be some kind of deduction for people who are saying, look, hey, I'm really taking care of myself. Come on, guys, cut me a little slack. Can I deduct some of this stuff?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think you should be able to do that. And depending on your employer, a lot of employers will work with you on that front. And in some of the more creative health insurance plans out there, you're starting to see more of that as, in a creative way of trying to lower overall costs. But yeah, I haven't been there in a while because I've been out on the campaign trail, but I am, both a CrossFit coach as well as a competitor and user. So I try to stay really healthy. I try to eat healthy. And absolutely, it would be great if I got to deduct from either my health insurance premiums or from my tax return, depending on which policy we're trying to push, that I got to deduct some of those expenses because I'm working hard on staying healthy and making good choices, recognizing, though, that that isn't always as easily accessible to every person as it maybe is to me. Living in a small town in the Roaring Fork Valley with access to the great outdoors and those kinds of things in a way that maybe somebody in an impoverished area in the San Luis Valley may not have access to those same choices in the same way that I do. So I think it's a great idea, but I also think that we need to recognize that everybody can't make the same choices that, say, I can or you can living in the Roaring Fork Valley.
Right, I agree with that, and the point of the question was to show the listeners that there is a concept of incentivizing, if you will, good behavior as opposed to enabling really bad behavior, and with the things I just mentioned. I mean, hopefully, there's no pipeheads listening to us. Well, if they are, maybe they should be listening and they should stop.
Right, absolutely.
But no, you get my point.
Absolutely. And I think that incentivizing good behavior is really important. And there's a lot of work out there in the social sciences about the concepts of nudges in our behavior. And that's a great way, you know, a person's pocketbook is a great way to give them the right kind of nudge and help to move in the right direction that is good for them and really will lower healthcare costs. So absolutely, I think there are opportunities for us to do that today inside of programs and health insurance plans that exist today, whether it's the VA, Medicare, Medicaid, or private insurers.
Fantastic. Now, I want to go back to that rural issue. Now, and this is something I think that is, you know, for our listeners here specifically, so please, I hope everyone's listening really carefully. The question is this: what can be done about elapsed time for acute medical care in rural areas? Because, and most, you know, statistically, there is about, 40,000 people to each hospital in most cases. However, in areas like this, we actually have more beds, but there is significant distance, that some people have. I mean, if you're living in Marble, the logistics may be extremely problematic as far as getting care for some acute situation. Whereas if you're in the middle of Denver somewhere, I mean, you're probably 2-3 minutes response time. But under ideal circumstances, I mean, even if you had vehicles that could go 100 miles an hour unfettered all the way from point A to point B, you're still going to be, you know, probably 20 minutes, 30 minutes turnaround time before you even get the person to a situation where they can be, taken care of or triaged in some kind of way.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
What do we do about that?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things going on there. And I think one of them is when we make our choices about where we live, recognize, I think, oftentimes that we have made a choice that makes access to acute care transport more difficult. I think that's part of it, and I think a lot of folks that are in that situation kind of acknowledge that. Although we have a real shift going on where more and more people are moving into those areas for a wide variety of reasons from, say, a metropolitan area where their level of service is much higher. Things that we can do about that, one is supporting local EMS and those rural districts that provide that EMS care. If and that really goes, frankly, to more of a state issue than a federal issue about how we fund. Most of them are special districts. I'll use, Aspen Fire Protection District or the Carbondale Rural Fire Protection District as examples where we as a community are coming together and saying these things are important and here's how we're going to fund them so we can deliver that acute care services as best as possible. You know, Marble is a great example of where it's tough because it's a place where you can't really fly into it effectively a lot of the year because of weather. So you can't rely on that kind of a transport system that some people would like to look to as the gold standard of acute care transport. Really, a lot of it boils down to building your community up from the bottom up, supporting those EMS responders that you have in your community, and frankly, being willing to help pay for those services to be made available to you at the local level. And on a statewide basis, there's also this issue of how do we address Tabor and the impacts it's having and is going to have on special districts. There, again, it's a state issue, but it's one that people really need to be aware of, that as those changes because of Tabor and the Gallagher Amendment are occurring this year, next year's cycle, a lot of these special districts are going to struggle on a budgetary front, and they know it's coming, and it's going to impact those things. So really paying attention to how, at the state level, the gubernatorial race, the state legislature, how they're dealing with those issues on a statewide basis, I think is going to be very important in acute care coming up, and emergency fire services as well.
Okay, so this is something that I've talked to a few people about. Marble's obviously not some gigantic community. It's not a huge I don't even know if it's a statistical metropolitan area. Probably not, but is it? Does it reach a threshold in size where, say, some tiny clinic that might be manned by, one or two or, three person staff that could render, you know, some kind of triage or medical services, you know, does it reach, I mean, is there a way of putting out, you know, outlier, very small clinics that would be, you know, maybe a little different from like from a battlefield, you know, medic that's running around on a battlefield, but you know, you're out there, there's no build, you know, there's not a lot of buildings, and maybe there's a tiny building that you might be able to get people to. And is that something that would make sense for our rural areas here?
You know, I think it might. I think one of the things that we need to be really careful about is distinguishing between acute care and emergent care, because the difference is significant not only from an insurance perspective and a cost perspective, but also the level of services that are being provided. You know, acute care might be something like I blew out my ACL, but I'm not in a life-threatening situation, or I broke my arm, but I'm not in a life-threatening situation, versus emergent care where I'm in the middle of cardiac arrest and I need a very high level of clinical services that really can't be provided at a remote acute care clinic unless you happen to be staffed by a cardiologist. So we need to be careful about saying, well, that's a solution to, it may be a solution to acute care. It's probably not a solution to emergent care, which there again really goes back to what's the how quickly can you respond and how soon can you get them to a facility that has that high level of care facility to deal with the emergent life-threatening issue that they are facing. So I think there's something to be said for those, for a rural clinic like that. But there again, we need to define the difference between acute and emergent care. I will tell you that even a hospital like the hospital in Cortez, I spent a couple of hours with the CEO over there a couple of weeks ago and really talking about how it's even for them providing that higher level of service is tough because of funding, because of remoteness of location. So they struggle with those same issues, even at a, I believe it's around a 40-bed hospital. So, you know, it's a tough issue. And I think really, from an acute care standpoint, if there are services that could be provided, I think that's a great idea. From an emergent care standpoint, I think we need to focus on how do we get that patient quickly to the level of care that they need to make a difference in that life-threatening situation.
Okay, and all right, excellent. I'm really, I think it's really important people do understand the difference in definitions between acute and emergent care, because that either obviously is a very major thing. I mean, one is something like, oh, gee, I mean, I'm in a lot of pain, but I'm not dead. And,
right.
Whereas the other thing is, boy, you know, my chest is tightening up a little bit here. You know, I might need the oxygen right away.
Right. Exactly.
All right. So, okay, now next thing is that, you know, we've got a few minutes left here, like 3 minutes.
Okay.
I guess very briefly, I'm going to have you give you two questions. How do we, the people, get price transparency from providers and pharmacies? Number one. Number two, what can be done to mitigate the end of life costs, 30 to 90 days of life, which, you know, is frequently most of the cost of healthcare that most people will ever get in their life is the last 30 to 90 days. And and then, you know, possibly if, you know, ethics boards, are those needed to make those kinds of decisions for people?
All right. So really easy on the first one, federal legislation. I did an op-ed on this particular issue on transparency and how to drive that transparency. But it's all of that information is available. We just need to have it put together in a way that we as consumers can really see that price transparency and can be educated on what it is we're consuming as a consumer of health goods, or of health services, if you will. As to end of life, I will tell you, having been through that with two parents, it is a very difficult time period for a family. I am really uncomfortable with the idea of some kind of third party making those decisions for a family. I can't tell you that I have a solution for that one other than being as educated as you can as a patient going into that. If you're looking at, for both of my parents, it was sort of age related. My mom in particular had very clear instructions about what end of life would look like. She had COPD. So I think it's more about the education piece, but I have to tell you, I'm really uncomfortable with a third party. I would not have wanted somebody to intervene in my family's decision about how my mom's life ended.
Right. I hear you there. And I've got 10 years on you, Carl, and I've had to deal with loss of one of my parents. So, and people who are baby boomers and past age 45 in general are now having to take a look at these as very significant issues that are absolutely life changing, for them. And they get damaged also by simply having to take care of that. I've got my mother over here in Carbondale, and she's at her last address that she's ever going to have. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And I don't want anyone to say, well, gee, Ed, we're going to pull the switch here now.
Right. Right.
So I hear you there. And I hope the audience that's listening really understands that these are, ethical questions, moral questions, and so very important. Carl, I want to thank you so very much for for making yourself available. And by all means, if you, get in touch with me, either directly through Sandy or reach the Katie and Kay staff, speak with them. Thank you once again so much. Great interview. Enjoy speaking with you. Hope to meet you at some point in time in the future.
All right. Sounds good. I really appreciate it, Ed. Thanks for the work you're doing.
Thank you, and have a great day.
All right. You too.